side by side wherever we go. We're always ready to roll. It's the Funk Zone Podcast with your host, Ted Mills.
Why, hello, 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 folks. Welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast. This is episode 64. What? I am your host, Ted Mills. Thank you for taking time out of your day to listen to me. It makes me feel wanted, safe, and protected. I'm quoting a Public Image Limited there. This is the show where I interview artists and creative people and try to find out why they do what they do. Okay, today on the show, we have Bill Farmer, taking the show a little bit south, this time to LA. Bill Farmer, currently best known as the voice of Goofy, Disney's Goofy. Is he a dog? Is he a sort of a dog hybrid? Who knows? He's just Goofy. And he's been doing that since 1987. So if you're a fan, or maybe your kids are, of the Goofy movie and Goof Troop, well, that's who we're talking to. Maybe you're interested in getting into a life of voiceover work. We'll get into that as well. What else has he done? He's also done some of the voices in Space Jam. He voices a secret squirrel in Harvey Birdman. And on Robot Chicken, he is the voice of Bugs and Daffy. So he gets to do those, even though he's not at Warner Brothers. In this interview, we talk about how he got into the business, the difference between Disney and Warner Brothers, how he learns voices and accents, and you'll hear me trying not to crank up, because please understand, Bill Farmer is doing all these voices a few feet away from me, and it's kind of intimidating. He just launches into it, and what can you do? You just got to laugh. This interview took place at Raleigh Studios in Los Angeles, and I'd like to thank Carol Marshall for making it happen, inviting me down to the Family Film Festival, where Bill Farmer was a guest. You can find Bill Farmer at billfarmer.net and on Twitter as Goofy Bill. Just before we get to the interview, I want to tell you about a super cool event I went to on Saturday night. It was the opening of SB Cast in downtown Santa Barbara on Garden Street, the 500 block of Garden Street. That is a new live-work site that promises to be a big incubator for artists and startups and tech people and all that kind of stuff. SB Cast stands for Santa Barbara Center for Arts, Science, and Technology. Ooh, and on Saturday night, I finally got to see the man called Dr. Megavolt. He's not there all the time. He was just there for the opening party. But he brings along a giant Tesla coil, and he plays with those dangerous arcs of electric current, like lightning, that shoot out of the coil, where he wears a kind of a suit, like a kind of a boiler suit with a birdcage on top of his head. It's just crazy. If you ever hear he's coming to your town, go see it. I shot a bit of it for Periscope. If you follow me on Periscope, you can guess what my name is on Periscope. It's Ted Mills. That's right. Periscope's kind of weird because I think for it to really be a good broadcast, you have to find something exciting. But usually when I'm at something exciting, I'm also being incredibly social, and people want to come up and talk to me and all that kind of stuff. So to film or not to film, that is the question there. But for the Dr. Megavolt, everyone just stopped what they were doing and watch him do that. So you go and check that out. If you miss the party, this is the reason I'm telling you this. If you miss the party, there will be a chance this coming first Thursday to see the new building in a more relaxed setting. So head down to 513 Garden Street after 5 p.m. and get a little tour of that place. You can check out SB Cast at sbcast.org. Go check it out, folks. I also mentioned last week that by now I'd have the merchandise store up, but that hasn't happened yet. I'm still testing it. It's still being glitchy. I don't want to rush and put it up just for the sake of putting it up and then have to deal with everybody's orders going weird. So you just have to wait. Be patient, my friends. All in due time. Meanwhile, follow me at the usual places on Twitter at Ted Mills and like us on Facebook at the Funk Zone Podcast. And of course, go over to funkzonepodcast.com and subscribe. And subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also show your support by pledging as little as $1 a podcast over at our page at patreon.com/funkzonepodcast. That is $4 a month. which is less than a delicious sandwich, even if you do have it toasted or not. Okay, folks, let's get to this interview. Let's get it going with Bill Farmer, recorded November 6, 2015, and now finally at the end of the assembly line, ready for you to drive off in it. Here we go.
All right, Bill Farmer.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Welcome.
Thanks.
The Funk Zone Podcast. We are somewhere in Raleigh Studios.
Yes, upstairs in a little nondescript office with interesting historical pictures on the wall.
And we're here because of the International Family Film Fest.
Right.
Tivol, I guess.
Tivol, yes. Tivol is important.
The 20th anniversary of this amazing
I didn't realize it was 20 years, wow.
It goes quickly. You're here to, well, you just did a talk.
I just spoke on the art of voiceover to in one of the theaters downstairs, and it was very successful. And I think people, I brought a lot of cartoons for the younger kids, too, so they enjoyed that.
Nice. You are the voice of Goofy.
I am, and Pluto, and over the years I've voiced a lot of Mel Blanc's voices for Warner Brothers, Foghorn Leghorn, Sylvester the Cat, Yosemite Sam, Bugs and Daffy, and all sorts of stuff over the years.
Those are shoes to fill, well, especially Mel Blanc.
Yes, yeah. I got to meet him shortly before he passed away, and he was working on Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and I got him to sign his autobiography to me, so... Too Goofy and from Mel Blanc. That was a big thrill for me because, of course, he is kind of the, he's a legend, if not a god to all of us voice actors.
Yeah. He's the godfather, would you say?
I would say he's the most well-known. There are some other ones. I took classes when I first came to Hollywood back in 1986 from a guy named Dawes Butler, who was just as talented, known for mostly the Hanna-Barbera characters, Yogi Bear, Huckleberry Hound, Snagglepuss, and about Captain Crunch, and just tons of other ones.
So, Mel Blanc, Dawes Butler. Who else is in the pantheon?
Oh, my goodness. Well, June Foray, who is still working, and she's like 98 years old now. So, this can be a long-term career commitment if you want it to be.
This is a long gig.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Because your voice doesn't change that much. I don't look the same way that I did in 1986 when I started coming out to Hollywood. And, my Goofy sounds pretty much the same now as it did back in 1987.
Nice. Guaranteed employment.
Hopefully. Not guaranteed, but it helps.
As guaranteed as it gets in Hollywood.
Yeah, right? That's the way to put it.
I shouldn't have said that word, guaranteed. Don't jinx it, man. Mr. Farmer, you're from Kansas. You're from Kansas. You're a Kansas boy.
I am. From a little farming community, south central Kansas, Pratt, Kansas, about 80 miles west of Wichita. And I think our only products were wheat and tornadoes.
Farmer by name, farmer by nature?
No, although I've certainly worked on farms. I was a city kid. My dad ran a department store in Pratt. So I was city kid. I'm also allergic to wheat dust, which would make it... I found that out while working on a farm once.
Oh, that's not the best...
I was not suited farm life.
Wow. Way to get out of it.
develop characters, yeah.
So growing up, no real farm life, department store life. I mean, are you hanging out in the store?
Yeah, as I say, it was a family run by my dad, my aunt, and my three uncles. Mm-hmm. They owned the department store. It was run by my grandparents, Jets Department Store in Pratt, Kansas. And they ran that for many, many years when they took it over in like the 30s or 40s, actually 40s for my dad, when he came to work there. And he did that till the late 60s, and then he worked at an irrigation company. So that was much more farm life, and I worked doing that, helping out in the summer. That was my summer employment, not acting.
Mm-hmm. What kind of student were you? What kind of childhood
I have ADD. I'm kind of the poster boy for ADD. So my teachers went, Billy, pay attention. You're looking out of the window. But there's a squirrel. So I was in detention a lot. I wasn't you know, I loved science. I'm a science junkie and nerd. But I wasn't that great a student because my mind just, I couldn't concentrate on, you know, it was a dark and stormy night. Oh, dark and stormy. I remember that storm we had like 3 years ago when, you know, the hailstones, oh, it had cracked my windshield and all, you know, I just can't keep my mind in a linear fashion. I'm off on all little tangents. It's tough for me to concentrate like
that.
They
didn't call it ADD back then.
No, it was being inattentive. It was being a problem, you know, and it was not paying attention. So, you know, that's what it was in those days.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Had there been, you know, medications back then, who knows what my career probably turned out for the best. So who knows? Maybe it was the birth of Goofy in me.
Yeah, that's right. You're just goofing around.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. But I always loved movies. Ever since I was a kid, I just gravitated toward television and the movies. And in those days, you know, it was like a quarter to go to the movies. In the summer, my parents would kind of get rid of me all day Saturday. We'd go down to the local theater, and they'd show movies basically all day. They'd show a double feature with the Three Stooges and cartoons. And I just loved that. I was kind of drawn to the fantasy kind of monster films. I loved that, the Ray Harryhausen used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first movie that I saw was really affected me was The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad by Ray Harryhausen. And seeing they had the Cyclops and they had the dragon and all of these other monsters and skeletons and stuff, and they're moving. And I thought to myself, man, that would be a fun job to make these films. Of course, there's no outlet for that in the middle of Kansas.
Yeah.
But I would have you know, my friends, and we would do, you know, I guess I always did something theatrically. We would have little plays in my basement. We'd write little things, and I shot little films on 8mm, trying to do, you know, special effects where we would, like, blow up a, you know, a house, and we make a little house out of, like, maybe popsicle sticks or something like that,
yeah,
and put a firecracker in it.
Yeah.
It didn't look as impressive on film as the movies, but it was our attempt at it.
Do those still exist somewhere?
I don't think so. There's a couple of them that supposedly do, but they've been lost, and who knows where they are right now.
At that time, you thought maybe you would be an actor or a director or writer?
I didn't think it was really possible because it was like a million miles away, no one that I knew had any connection to show business. The closest, I always dreamed of doing it, but it, you know, my parents were pretty pragmatic and always kind of pushing me towards something that had a little bit more stability in it.
Hmm.
That acting was considered a very risky profession, and it is.
Yeah.
Luckily, I couldn't be dissuaded, and it just took a long time to get to it, into my 30s, before I really gave it a shot, came to Hollywood. But I always had the bug. And my degree was in broadcast journalism from the University of Kansas. So, with that, I figured radio was the closest thing that I could do, which turned out to be a great training ground. Because the little podunk stations that I worked at in Oklahoma and Texas and Kansas would allow me the freedom to create characters on the air. They didn't care, so if we'd have a rock and roll show, I'd bring in Wolfman Jack. Oh, yeah, baby. We're going to be playing a lot of rock and roll today, baby. And so I would do these characters, not knowing there's, like, copyright laws or whatever that Wolfman had.
I was going to say.
I wasn't worried about
that. You didn't get a call from Wolfman Jack's lawyers?
No, they didn't. We were way too small for that. But the people, you know, probably, we got Wolfman Jack on our station. We only got 1,000 people in this town. And it was fun, so I would create characters, and it allowed me to have fun. I would also write commercials for local, you know, department stores or whatever, and I would try and make them funny or come up with different styles, and I did a lot of radio production in those days, and so, you know, I might do, in the old days, Howard Cosell, come down, see all of the great shirts on sale today only, Saturday. Yeah, that kind of thing. Do little parodies and stuff. But it was a great place to be bad at it. you need a place to be bad.
Yeah, that
and
is true.
And that was my outlet for that. And it kind of taught me a little bit about writing. It taught me about doing voices, making the characters come alive a little bit. So I was ready for Hollywood when it came about, or stand-up, actually, is what I went into after radio. And that was back in March of 82.
Ooh.
I lived in Dallas at the time.
So you'd gone to from Kansas to, it sounded like you went to all these places.
I did. I was you know, all over. I was in New York for a little while right after college. I was in Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas with radio. I got out of radio because there wasn't any money in it, and I went. Actually, it was on the. It was to kind of save my skin. I always had a background in science. Was it the engineer at one? I knew enough about electronics to really be dangerous, and I was able to get a first-class FCC license, so they made me the engineer. At one of the radio stations in Kansas, I got the manual for a new transmitter, and there was these outlined areas in red, which said, caution, death on contact.
Yeah.
Very high voltage amperage. It would kill you instantly if you touched that. I said, I don't know enough about this stuff. So I went to Dallas to a place called Elkins Institute of Technology, kind of like a DeVry kind of thing, to learn about electronics enough that I wouldn't kill myself. And it would also make me more valuable for radio stations. Well, I did that and then did a little bit more radio, but I was tired of that. I moved back to Dallas and worked in an electronics company for about 2.5 years, totally out of the realm of show business altogether. But it bugged me. I'm not a 9-to-5er. I'm not a cubicle kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And my life changed on March 16th of 1982 when I went down to a comedy club in Dallas called the Comedy Corner. And you could go up and do 5 minutes of stand-up comedy. Anyone could do that if you signed up beforehand. Ooh, and I watched the show and I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to give this a shot. The next week I went in, and that happened to be the March 16th of 82. I wrote a little 5-minute comedy routine, impression routine, and got great response. And the house comic at the comedy club, who's famous now, named Bill Engvall, said, why don't you, you got something. You ought to keep coming back here. I think you got something.
Hmm.
So I started coming back. Within a few months, I was starting to do some comedy clubs in Houston and, Amarillo and other places around Texas. And I became a full-time stand-up comic.
And so you're doing impressions. You're doing
Rich Little, a lot of impressions.
Travelina,
yes.
That kind of stuff.
I was doing that kind of a routine. I did that from 1982 until 1986. When I decided, along with my wife, I got married in 1984 in Dallas, my wife Jennifer, and we decided, well, if we're going to do this stuff, we ought to try Hollywood. My agent said, yeah, with all the voices you do, you ought to give it a shot in animation.
Who are your voices at the time?
Doing my voices, yes.
Yeah, no, who are your voices? Who were you doing?
First one I think I did was Don Adams, I'll Get Smart. Well, of course, John Wayne and all of those Western stars that they had back in the old days. Well, and Walter Brennan, a lot of them sidekicks. And I was always doing that there Pat Buttram, who was Gene Autry's sidekick. And those were some of my favorite voices. Of course, Johnny Carson, an exciting voice to do. And those were the kind of voices that I did in my act. I came out here, got an apartment in the summer of 86.
Where were you?
It was on Poinsettia Avenue in Hollywood. I figured, if you're going to be in Hollywood, go to Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
I expected, I guess, to see all the celebrities walking down the street. And no, it wasn't quite like that. You hear gunshots and stuff. But so I got this little kind of seedy apartment on Hollywood, just off of Hollywood Boulevard, near Man's Chinese Theater. Actually, it's only a street or two over from that.
Yeah, yeah.
Got an apartment. About 4 months later, my agent said, do you do any of the Disney characters? And I said, well, I can kind of do it. I can do a Mickey. Gosh, oh boy, and gosh, Goofy, I can kind of do that. Can't do a Donald too well. I can only go, that's about it.
Yeah.
But I auditioned for those voices. actually, I had tried out, I think, for Mickey and Goofy. And the reason was, at the time, there were four or five guys doing Mickey and Donald and Goofy, but Roy Disney and Michael Eisner wanted consistency, so you always heard the same voice. The big audition, probably a couple of thousand people tried out for it. They liked mine. And I did my first job the week, I think it was January, I think 23rd or 26th of 1987. It was a show called Disney's Doggone Valentine. And I just had to do one line of dialogue.
Really? One line?
One line.
What
but
was that line?
It was two-picture, which I never looped anything, where you're looking at the actual movie and replacing the dialogue. I said something like, well, I put my foot on the accelerator and I'm out of here quick. But I had to do it to replace the dialogue that was in the cartoon. Terrifying for me, because I was so green, I didn't know how a recording studio worked out here. And at that time, I met the guy who does Donald Duck, still does to this day, Tony Anselmo. He is also an animator, and he was sitting there drawing and doodling Donald. And I'm thinking, well, we don't have to draw these guys, do we?
Is that how
someone
it works?
Made a horrible mistake? I thought we just talked like. Well, luckily, he's an animator, so luckily, and I can't draw worth anything. Luckily, I just had to talk like Goofy, and that went pretty well. And they called me in about a month later to do another job, and then the second one was another DTV. It was called DTV's Monster Hits, and it was a Halloween show, and I got to share a microphone with. Announcer on Laugh-In, I'm having Gary Owens.
Gary Owens, yes.
And he had that great radio voice. And we got to share a microphone and do that NBC Peacock opening. And he would say, the following program is brought to you in living color. And I would say, in stereo on NBC. And I was so thrilled and excited because I got to work with a celebrity and he was so nice. What, very supportive, and, well, it's wonderful to meet you, Bill. It'll be a lot of fun, and we'll have a great time. And he was just delightful to work with, and it was just thrilling for me to work with someone I'd seen on TV and was in awe of. And that session went well, and then they called me in again and again and again and again, and they're still calling me in. After 28 years, they're still calling me in, and I've done about 3,500 different jobs for Disney over those last 28 years.
Wow. You kept count, kind of.
Roughly. Someone asked me how many. I kind of calculated roughly how many I've done.
Wow. Where is Goofy from? I mean, is he from Kansas? Is that a Kansas
Pinto Colvig, who originated the voice, was from Oregon.
Well, that's not an Oregon.
No, it's not really. It's kind of a Midwest. I think of it as, well, Walt grew up in Marceline, Missouri, just outside Kansas City. And that's kind of my old stomping territories, too. When I went to University of Kansas, that's not far away. So I kind of think of him as a Missourian or Kansan, kind of a Midwest accent. Mm-hmm. But he's kind of a one-of-a-kind kind of thing. So he's got his own voice.
See, I feel like the Warner Brothers characters are vaudeville Borscht Belt.
Yes,
and Disney
absolutely.
Is Midwest.
You know, and Bugs Bunny was, Mel came up with him as a Bronx accent. Hell, brother, ain't I a stinker? So, yeah, he had that New York kind of sound.
Yeah, but Disney is very
Midwest. I think that reflected Walt's sensibilities.
Yeah. What about Pluto?
Pluto, I have been doing, actually, I did that, I don't believe I did that on the first show, but at least by the second show, I did, they asked me if I could, fill in for Pluto and do that, and, I was able to.
Yeah.
And so I picked up Pluto's voice, kind of as an addition, because I could do it, and Pinto Colvig, who did Goofy, also did Pluto from time to time. I think there were several people that did it, but he was one of the people that did. So the voice match, I guess, was pretty easy for me.
Because at the time when you got that job, that was sort of a fallow period, I think, right, for those characters.
Yeah, they've really come back weren't doing that much with them.
Yeah.
And with the advent of the Disney Channel and when Michael Eisner came into the company and the company started coming up and getting to be the giant it is today, they needed that consistency, and they were starting to produce cartoons with the Disney Afternoon, and people saw these characters a lot more. So I came in at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Now, what you did to get that job, which is doing looping on the existing footage, mm-hmm. that's not how it's done usually, right? You go and do the voices
it
first.
It is and it isn't. The principal recording is done just off of a script. You're in a studio with a microphone and the script, and the director kind of tells you a little bit about the scene and what you do, but I just have a script and I'm working off of that. And anymore, we don't even record ensemble like we did in the old days, which is like where we do it like a radio play, maybe 10 actors in a room doing the cartoon like a radio play. Now I go in and do my lines. Mickey will do his lines. Donald will do his lines. They take the best takes of each of us, put them together in editing, and it seems to work out better for production purposes.
Production purposes, mm-hmm. but does it not work out for performance purposes?
It's tougher.
Don't you miss people?
Because I have to rely on the director.
Yeah.
I'll say, how far away is Mickey? If he's standing right next to me, I might go, gosh, howdy there, Mickey, what you doing? You know, if he's across the room, howdy, Mickey, how you doing? If he's 50 feet away, gosh, howdy, Mickey! You know, I have to account for where he is. The situation determines a lot of the way that you act something. And the situation all gives you the emotional input. If the house is on fire, you're going to be a little bit more frantic than you would be if you're sitting around watching television.
Hmm.
That situation determines how the acting goes. And I get that from the director.
How long did it take you to learn the rules of Goofy, I guess? Like what Goofy does and doesn't do?
Probably a couple of years. When I first started, it's doing an impression. I was doing an impression of Goofy.
Hmm.
I wasn't Goofy. I didn't feel the character. I didn't know how the character thought. I didn't know how he would say every sentence. For the first year, I was probably doing most dialogue that had been written for Goofy for something else. Or it was written in Goofy-ese. Then a couple of years in, they had a program called State Farm at Disneyland, and I got to do the monorail spiel. You know, we're now traveling 30 miles an hour. And I had to do that spiel as Goofy, but I didn't know how to do it because it wasn't written for Goofy. It wasn't written in the way that he speaks.
Yeah.
And through that, I had to kind of figure out and delve deeper into the character and figure out the soul of Goofy, if you will. And once you get that, once you get the soul of the character and where he lives, the essence of the character, then you learn how to say anything as that character, and it rings true.
Yeah.
Because it's not an impression, it is being the character. And it's coming from within. And that's the whole secret to voice acting, really, is capturing that soul, that essence, the emotional life of the character.
Mm. It seems that over the last, in the resurgence of Disney, but also with Pixar, that a lot of name celebrities are called on to do voiceover, and there's a loss of voice character actors as yourself. But you seem to have weathered that. Has that affected you in a certain way?
Oh, sure. That's kind of a misnomer a little bit, that they didn't used to do that. If you go back to, take some of the Disney, you go back to Alice in Wonderland. They had Ed Wynn as the Mad Hatter. Oh, yes, Alice. They had Jerry Colonna. They had all of these Sterling Holloway character actors who portrayed, Winnie the Pooh is for Sterling Holloway and everything. They did use actors.
Mm-hmm.
Some were more famous than others. Most of them were bit players or character actors that lent their voice to animation rather than the big A-list stars who kind of were lofty and above all of that.
Mm.
What has happened in the last several years is that the big A-list actors love doing the characters and have come in. For example, on a show I'm on now called The 7D, which is The Seven Dwarves, basically. It's on Disney XD. It's kind of a reinvention of the Seven Dwarves. I'm Doc in that character, who has kind of he's very intelligent. He's kind of the leader of the dwarves, and so he speaks very rapidly and articulately. But they have a crystal ball,
mm-hmm.
and who tells jokes, and it's Jay Leno, We have the Talking Mirror, who's Whoopi Goldberg. They don't need the cash for this, but they have fun doing it.
Yeah.
And it does take away some of the jobs from voice actors, but it's always been a very competitive, very tough business. As I tell students these days, there's roughly 150 to 200,000 Screen Actors Guild members in the Los Angeles area. On any given week, there's maybe 10,000 acting jobs. Hmm. So on any given week, there's like 150,000 out-of-work actors. Very tough.
Yeah.
Very tough. Getting into this business is also like coming out of high school and joining the NBA. You are up against all of these greats that are performing at such high level. It's tough to compete against the best in your field. Now, luckily, they can't do everything, and there are opportunities for other actors. And as things go on, there's with the internet, and with all of the channels that are on television, there are more shows. So there's more work, but there are more people doing the work. So it's still very competitive to get the jobs.
Yeah.
That's probably 80, 90% of what I do is getting my next job.
Yeah.
Except for Goofy, they just kind of call me.
Yeah.
but other characters and announcing and all of those, I still audition all the time.
Yeah. It sounds like you got your break because of all the impressions that you could do. Is that still a way to get in? Because if you go onto YouTube, you'll find a lot of people saying, I'm going to do 50 people in 10
yes.
minutes or something like that.
Which is great.
Is
and
that
it's
a
very,
good way to go?
It's very useful. But then again, if they cannot capture the soul of the character, the reads that they will give will sound somewhat hollow.
Hmm.
They will sound lifeless. They don't have a soul. That's the secret to voice acting. It's capturing the inner life of that character. And if you're doing a great impression, it can still sound like it's read or performed rather than that you are being a character that has a wacky voice. You are doing a wacky voice. And there's a difference. And you can hear that. That's why the great actors, the great voice actors, don't necessarily do impressions, but they capture the soul of a character and the style of a character and bring it to life. The ability to bring those pages to life is what really separates the good from the great voice actors.
Hmm. Do you study voices, other people's voices,
yes.
all the time?
All the time. When I'm in a car, I'll listen to announcers and I'll try and get down I listen to the, we went to, like, Dodger Stadium a year or so ago. And, of course, I'm sitting there trying to do my Vin Scully.
Yeah, Vin Scully.
And kind of work on, it's time for Farmer John Hot Dogs and a Budweiser. You know, and so I'm starting. You just kind of, you start playing with it and playing. You know, and it doesn't matter if you're a good impressionist. As a matter of fact, Dawes Butler used to tell me that all he was a bad impressionist. Hmm. When he did Yogi Bear, it was a guy that he knew in Chicago. Hey! He modified that. He was doing an impression.
Yeah.
Captain Crunch, who, ahoy, mateys. He was doing an impression of an early actor, I think a guy named Charles Butterworth, who I don't even know who that is. But I know Captain Crunch, and I know the way that he used to speak. He was doing a bad impression.
Hmm.
Huckleberry Hound was a cousin of his in South Carolina.
Oh, really?
And so I had that deep south kind of thing. And he was just picking up that up. So, you know, you can impersonate anybody and come up with a new voice. Even if you're good at it, sounds like the person. If it doesn't, it's something new, and you got a character.
Is there a Southern Californian accent? Do I have one? What do I have?
You're kind of a very, very neutral kind of character.
Ooh.
Of course, when you think California, you kind of think of surfer dude.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know?
So I don't have that.
No.
I don't have that.
Yeah, it's kind of the neutral accent, I guess.
I feel like California either has this, what you're saying, the surfer, or it's everyone's coming from everywhere else, so it's this.
Yeah, it's kind of an amalgam of everything.
Yeah. I mean, when you said the original Goofy is from Oregon.
Yes.
It's like, is there an Oregon accent?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
I just,
what happens out here?
Right.
We come to the coast and
it goes away.
What other accents fascinate you outside America?
Oh, well, of course, you know, there's lockdown. And I was in Australia not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they always, like, got that nasal thing going on. They're great people down there. I like that. When I go down there on Comic-Cons, which I did this earlier this year, down there I always have people write out their name so that when I do an autograph.
Yeah.
I remember a guy came up to me and goes, "My name is Bean." And I go, "Bean, what? Bean? What? How do you spell it?" "Oh, Bean. B-E-N. Bean."
Yeah.
"Oh, Ben." Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you know, with all the names, you know, I have them write it out.
Yeah.
That's how. Okay.
Can you tell the difference between an Aussie and a Kiwi?
I can't. I can't do it. I haven't studied it that much. It's more English in New Zealand. A Kiwi is a little bit more British, whereas Australian, it's like, you know, rounded vowels, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Crikey, you know, all that sort of stuff.
I think that one of the things is, for English accents, there's British in my background.
Yes.
Right, I'm first generation American. But their accents have three levels for every area because there's class.
Yes.
So you have a lower class.
The upper crust, you know. Yeah. One of those little, I'm going to help myself in the spot of tea. You know, one of those sort of people. Oh, there's a very, you know, kind of nasal. Oh, yes, of course. Penelope, it's time for tea.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Then you get the lower class. Oh, it's a night for the Ripper, Eddie's. You know,
yeah,
Cockney and all of those things. Then you go north, it gets like the Beatles or sound like it from Liverpool.
But if you were the upper crust in Liverpool, you wouldn't sound like the Beatles.
Yeah, I don't know how they would.
It shaves off.
It does. It does. Interesting. The class definitely affects it.
That doesn't happen here so much, except unless you're talking about older East Coast families where they're almost British.
They are. There's that kind of faux British.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not all the way British, but it is more of an American, but it is very articulate, and it's very... They watch their words.
Oh, I could talk about that stuff all day, man. What you got coming up?
Oh, goodness. Well, I've been very fortunate. This year has been very busy. I've been traveling. I was on the... Disney cruise ship to Alaska, giving a lecture on voiceover. Another one, Disney cruise ship to the Bahamas and their island Castaway Key, which leaves out of Port Canaveral. Did that. I was in Australia earlier this year. I was in Knoxville, Tennessee at a Comic-Con just a couple of weeks ago. This last week, I was had one of the highlight. I was performing with Richard Sherman, who... He, along with his brother Robert, wrote all of the songs for Disney, everything in Mary Poppins, Academy Award winning. And I was on stage with Donald Duck at the Disney Family Museum in San Francisco. They were raising money for classes for kids that want to get into animation and everything. And it was a big gala event, but John Lasseter was there, and Ron Miller, who ran the company even before Michael Eisner, and all of these, highfalutin kind of people. And we just had a great time. The next day we got a tour of the Walt Disney Family Museum with Joanna Miller, who's Walt's granddaughter. How many people get a tour with Walt's granddaughter showing us, this is what Uncle Walt did? It was exciting. And then they had arranged a tour of Pixar. And I got to go on that campus. And, of course, I've done background voices and looping and a lot of the Pixar movies over the years. So I was in that movie. I was in that movie.
What were you in the Pixar films?
Toy Story 2, Bug's Life, Monsters, Inc., Monsters University, earlier Disney films, Beauty and the Beast, Tarzan, Hunchback of Notre Dame, a lot of Cars, a lot of movies over
the
years.
Who were you in Toy Story?
Incidental voices, background voices, crowd scenes in Toy Story, for example, they go through the Pizza Planet, and I was the mission control saying, T-minus 29, 28, 27. You never know. It's looping is fairly interesting because you never know what they're going to use in the movie till you see the movie.
Yeah.
Monsters, Inc., some of the little yellow guys that find the sock on the one monster he came back. I was some of those. Crowd scenes in Beauty and the Beast. I always tell a story. Sometimes you get to do sound effects in one scene in Beauty and the Beast, Gaston is singing, and he's in a bar and stuff, and he throws three eggs up in the air, mm-hmm. and he swallows them. That's me. I'm eggs.
You're just the eggs.
I'm eggs. No, eggs is on my resume. Yes, I also do omelets. You know.
Are you in the credits as?
Oh, you're probably in the loop group. Eggs. Yes, yes.
Oh, it doesn't say eggs.
No, not eggs. Ah, egg.
Oh, okay. Do you ever hear your performance and Forget It's You?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. We went to the movie Shrek 2, and I did the loop group on that. And I went with my son, and toward the end, there was a big party, a ball at the castle, and the announcement said, "Ladies and gentlemen, introducing Princess Fiona and Prince Shrek." And my son said, "That's you, Dad?" And I, yeah, I didn't even recognize. I forgot I did it. Sometimes, you know, you never know.
Well, Mr. Farmer, thank you so much for talking.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
In all the different voices.
It was my pleasure.
All right, man. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you.
There you have it, folks. Bill Farmer in interview on the Funk Zone podcast. That was fun to sit down with him. We didn't have enough time, really, I felt, because there's a whole bunch of other stuff he does, including his stand-up career, which we didn't really get into. When I found out a little bit later when he mentioned it in passing, but we all had moved on from them. It was also interesting to wander around the Raleigh studios down in LA and check that out and have a nose about. For me, you can, as usual, follow me on Twitter at Ted Mills and on Facebook at Funk Zone Podcast, and subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. And also, don't forget Patreon, patreon.com/FunkZonePodcast. Oh, yeah, show your support. Okay, that is it for me now. I'll be back next week for another interview. And I'm going to leave the last word, as usual, to my second grade friend, Joe. Take it away, Joe. Tell us what you know. See you later, folks.
And now for a big goodbye. See you soon. We'll make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make more tapes later on. Yeah. See you soon. Bye.